Welcome to Cloud Radio, made for full-stack cloud operators. Cloud Radio covers all aspects of the business of software. All right. I'm happy to have Matt Slotnick. He is a guest we've been looking forward to having. I've been admiring his perspectives and takes about AI on Twitter. He's got a good background as well. He was in venture capital at Norwest. He was at Google. And now he's the founder of a sales AI workspace that's backed by Excel and Spark. So he's got a great perspective. Matt, you want to tell folks a little bit more about yourself and your company?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Matt. And happy to be here. Thanks for the kind words. Not quite sure what people make of the take, so glad to have a fan here and there. But yeah, great to be here. I'm Matt, co-founder CEO of Pogeo Labs. Prior to starting Pogeo, I spent about 4 years at Google Cloud, working on a variety of things, sort of joined initially as a PM on a product called Apigee, which is a company Google had acquired. Spent 2 years kind of working on our roadmap there into kind of integration, iPaaS type products. And then spent the latter 2 years working under the new Google Cloud leadership that had come up from Oracle to basically build a business unit around low code and no code, which sort of started to be on my journey towards a little bit more towards the application layer. Prior to Google, I was an investor focused basically on everything below the application layer. So data, distributed systems, security, open source, developer tools, all that stuff. And then while at Google, kind of moved up the stack and spent a bunch of time, you know, building and executing on our low code, no code strategy, which led to Pogeo. And, you know, we're now a couple iterations into the Pogeo product, and kind of funny, a lot of things in technology tend to be somewhat cyclical. So a lot of the trends that we were looking at in low code and no code, I think have actually arrived now with AI in an even greater way. And so that's kind of been a nice, you know, things kind of rhyme. It's been a nice full circle experience for me.
Awesome. Well, that's great background. And, you know, one easy part about this show is I'm literally going to be able to read some of your tweets because they are so prescient. And one theme I've really liked and I'm trying to use, as I understand AI, is viewing everything at the workflow level. It's very easy to generalize and miss the mark. And so I'm going to read this tweet. I'm seeing that next-gen AI apps require a dramatically more intimate understanding of end-user workflows than previous generation SaaS, which creates fundamental differences in product decisions and team construction. I'm thinking this might be underappreciated at the moment. And then later, you had a follow-on tweet. I think there is a class of product that takes this even further, where the actual product value delivered is net new, e.g., not an optimization of existing software process, but automation of pieces of a workflow that software couldn't meaningfully touch before. So I guess whatever you want to expound on like your focus on being at the workflow level.
Yeah. So one of the kind of really interesting things about AI that sort of became more and more apparent as we went through last year is, if you look at existing software systems, I think systems of record are just generally a good way to look at this stuff. So we'll use Salesforce because it's the example that I am most familiar with and spend my day thinking about. If you actually look at Salesforce and what Salesforce was designed to do, and the reason that a lot of sales reps don't like it and sales managers do like it is because it sort of is a manager tool, right? It's kind of a, it's basically a meme to talk about how Salesforce isn't built for salespeople, it's built for the manager, blah, blah, blah. So if you actually look at like a system of record, it's basically like almost like a metadata catalog for the work that has happened somewhere else. It gets entered into the CRM so that you can report on it and so you can track on it. And if you actually think about what a sales rep does in a day, like if you were to sit over a sales rep's shoulder and look at everything they do day to day, there's probably hundreds or thousands of tasks, right? They go to Google, they go to LinkedIn, they look something up, they write an email, they go to a sales enablement repository to go pull some verbiage to put in the email. Like there's all these things that they do. Essentially, none of that has anything to do with the CRM. The CRM gets periodically updated with a deal status and a deal amount and a bunch of things. And so you kind of have this system of record. And then historically, software for salespeople didn't actually really help them with much of the day-to-day. Like that day-to-day happened in Google Docs and in email and in their brain and in phone calls and all these sorts of things. And so one of the things, though, that's really interesting about AI products, and you know, this applies to sales and Salesforce, but I think this applies really, really broadly, is you actually have an opportunity to automate pieces of that day-to-day workflow. So the drafting of emails is a kind of obvious example. Things like that, where you're actually embedding yourself in the day-to-day of the workflow across systems, rather than software kind of being this thing that sits somewhat, even front office software still sits behind the scenes as this kind of thing that you have to update. And so I think the thing that you have to, or the thing that's worth appreciating about this new generation of software, if you believe this hypothesis, is that you're actually embedding in the workflow itself. And this requires you to understand the workflow in a way that your product is executing workflows that make a 25-year sales veteran say, like, yeah, that's right. That does the right thing. And that is just fundamentally different than the way things worked before. And, you know, Salesforce was always about workflow. Systems of record were always about workflow. They have this opinion on how the workflow should work, but the actual work of the workflow happens elsewhere. It just gets captured at various points in the system of record. And so I think if you almost kind of turn it inside out, and so you have to build products from the vantage point or the sort of point of view of being like deeply embedded in literally the things that a person is doing every day. And I think that really is almost just like a fundamentally different product than an existing CRUD application. And I think people don't realize that yet to the degree that I think they will in the future.
Yeah, it seems to imply you just need to understand the workflow at a radically deeper level. And related to that, in your tweet, that seems to require fundamental differences in product decisions and team construction. Particularly on the team construction, how are you addressing the workflows and that level of understanding?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things there. Like one, if you kind of think about just AI from a technical perspective, the outputs that you generate are from prompts, right? And so, and there's a bunch of other things you kind of wrap around a prompt, but you kind of have to know how to steer the system towards like good outputs. And so you kind of almost embed best practices in the day-to-day of an expert into the system. And so that requires a lot of experimentation. It requires knowing what good looks like, right? Because this is one of these things where, you know, I think it's actually quite easy to, and I would suspect that there's probably a lot of companies out there in all sorts of different verticals where they're like, hey, these outputs are great. Like this is doing like really good stuff. And if you showed it to like someone that's kind of new in the industry, they'd be like, yeah, that's awesome. Whereas if you go show it to a person that's been doing this for 25 years, they'd be like, well, yeah, but that's like, that's the thing that a new grad would do before they know the right way to do it. And so you kind of end up with these like systems that need to match the capabilities of experts. And so it's a benefit, but it's also a little bit of a curse because, you know, with a system like a CRM, you kind of like let people figure out how they want to implement it. There's people whose job is to go and configure and customize the CRM, and there's sort of guardrails for what can go in and what can go out if you set it up right. With AI, it's like, you know, someone's going to ask a question or you're going to give them an answer, and that answer basically embeds best practices in an industry into like the actual tech stack. And there's all sorts of really interesting things that kind of come from a technical perspective there. But at the core of it, you don't just ask ChatGPT like, hey, do sales for me really good. It just doesn't work like that, right? Like you have to have this really deep understanding of all the different pieces that go together into every piece of that sale process. And I think that's where, I mean, even just having, you know, the concept of industry expertise, I think changes a little bit because you have to have products that almost act like sales, in our case, act like a salesperson and sort of behaves like a salesperson. And that takes just time, like frankly, it's a lot of experimentation on the technical side, but also just almost on the natural language side of like, literally, how do you prompt these systems? And over time, you can do things to optimize that. But at the core, like you kind of have to figure out your user in a really intimate way, which I think a lot of technical folks don't tend to like to do.
And so like, you know, from a tactical perspective or to frame this for folks listening, do you have to do like a multiple of customer interviews, customer dialogue to what you might do in SaaS or like, you know, even what you were working on APIs at Google, like, you know, relatively well established, like how are you approaching this tactically?
Yeah. So if you kind of rewind before we started building this product, it was literally 6 or 8 weeks where all I did was talk to salespeople. Like, it was literally like, what do you do all day? Like, describe to me what you do and where you do it. And we just had this, and, you know, we'd been having conversations with sales reps and sales leaders for years. And so this is one of these things where it was literally like, I want to understand the surface area of the things that you do day to day so that I can figure out where I can start and where I can expand over time and what the product that you need to build to kind of start with one piece of that and then have the sort of the affordances to scale over time. And that's where I think you get into some like pretty gnarly product and design decisions and problems that are completely net new because these things don't exist yet. And that was, it's scary, but it's also exciting. And I think that's where, if you're kind of looking for phase changes and new types of applications and new types of use cases, that's where this comes from, because you're kind of like automating a fundamentally new unit of value that you couldn't touch before.
Yeah. And it creates this like really interesting dynamic, right? We'll use traditional SaaS that, you know, task management, project management, reporting, data, right? The customer sorts it all out, right? You're just really providing frameworks and guardrails. And now here, you're literally doing the work or right in the work. And so when you have an opinion on, in your case, like how does an expert salesperson communicate or how do they go sell and communicate with their customers? When your company has an opinion, right, that creates its own problem, right? If someone's like, no, this is not the way. And like, are you able to have five opinions, five options, or five best practices embedded in what you do? Or do you have to, you know, with some challenges of AI or the prompting side, the engineering side, kind of have to have one and then go deal with the customers who might not like that?
Yeah. So this is a question that can go a lot of different ways. There's technical answers to it. This actually gets into some really interesting pieces of AI products around sort of contextualizing outputs for individual users. What I'll say though is one of the things that I really like about at least our market, and one of the reasons we're in the market that we chose and why we're working with sales reps and building a tool to augment sales reps at the end of the day, is we're not building a black box, right? This isn't, hey, you want to go book 1,000 meetings a month and we're going to give you this AI box that you deploy and then meetings will show up. We're building something where there's an expert in the loop, the expert being the salesperson. And so actually by design, a piece of the way that we built our product is that the outputs and the sort of answers that it gives you, they're not necessarily the right answer, because there isn't a right answer, right? Like if I'm a sales rep and I'm trying to sell something to you, there is not a canonically right account plan that I can create to go sell the thing that I want to sell. I have an opinion as a sales rep that might be different from the person sitting next to me. It might be different today as opposed to next Monday. And so you have all sorts of reasons that the outputs actually should be different, which I think is one of the things that if you look at a lot of conversations around AI, people sometimes struggle with this idea that the outputs are non-deterministic, that I'll ask a question right now, and if I ask the same question in an hour, I might get something different. And that to people, I think, breaks your brain a little bit, because in traditional CRUD apps, it's like, well, if I ask for the forecast is the forecast. If I ask you for the forecast at 9 a.m. and then I ask for it again at 10 a.m. and no deals have closed, it should be the same. But in these sort of AI product worlds, at least, and I think there's a lot of different applications of AI products, but a very particular sort of AI product that we're building is you actually want this because it's a thought partner, right? It's like, here is a way that you might want to position your product with your customer based on all this information that you know, and you actually want the sort of sales brain to be thinking about that and giving you an answer such that if you ask it again, you might get a slightly different answer. Because at the end of the day, it's the sales rep that takes that information and molds it based on their expertise and how they think and their intuition and all these sorts of things to go ultimately have a conversation with a customer or do whatever it is they're going to do. And so for us, we have this sort of notion of, we're building a human in the loop system where it gives you ideas. Some of the ideas might be bad, but sometimes bad ideas help you come up with good ideas. And so it's one of these things where we actually have sales reps who are iterating with Pogeo as a thought partner for how best to crack an account, how best to prepare for objections that the CIO of a retail company might have for their specific SKU of their specific product. And there's no right answer to that, right? There's not like just a list of 10 objections. They're going to change. And when you get more information, maybe you ingest a Gong call and you learn that this person, I don't know, hates the cloud, like that's going to change your objections. And so this is, it's sort of this kind of, again, there's this sort of new interaction pattern that you have to get users comfortable with, because it is very different than the way people have interacted with apps in the past.
Yeah, it sounds like a huge managing user expectations challenge. And then some of this is a question of like how much of this just goes away naturally, right? As we all get used to working with software differently. Like for myself personally, just using Perplexity AI for search type work has kind of changed how I even think about Google, which was some area I had not really adjusted. I had just used it as the default, and you're kind of with familiarity, yeah, okay, it's 10% of hallucinations, or I have to rerun the query. And in many ways, it's my thought partner. And that some of this will naturally go away. But besides me pontificating here, like, how are you managing user expectations, like within your own app, and trying to not let people get frustrated by some of these dynamics?
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting time for that, because there's things that people are, if they're kind of paying attention to the news, they're almost pre-trained to expect might not work. So everyone knows what a hallucination is. So anytime they see anything that isn't what they think it should be, it's a hallucination. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. I think for us, one of the things that is a little bit of a guardrail against some of that is, again, kind of going back to the idea that like, there are some canonically wrong answers. Like there are facts that could be wrong, and we do a lot of work to minimize those, having those not appear in the app. And there's a lot you can do to kind of ground it in truth and cross-check data sources and a bunch of things like that. But for us, I think it's really around like almost like nudging people to interact with the system in a sort of interactive way, I guess, not to overcomplicate it. It's like, think of it as a thought partner, ask it a question, ask it to clarify that question. And really getting people to kind of understand that the getting to the right answer is an iterative process, in the same way that one of the kind of examples that comes up a lot for us is in sales, you often have kind of like a war room or a QBR or something where a bunch of people get in a room, they talk about how they're going to go crack accounts, they go present their account plans, and you just kind of jam on like what we should do. And you can do that with Pogio, which is weird, actually. Like objectively, it's sort of weird to be iterating and having a little computer on your screen that kind of, you know, helps you work through these ideas like your VP of sales might, or like your sales manager might. And so I think for us, there is this big education challenge. And look, we're still really early in on this and don't have the answers, but there's a lot of education to kind of push people to experiment and push people to almost view the system as a, it's kind of weird, not like necessarily like as a person, but as a being that you can communicate with. And that's how you get the best answers. And it's also going to learn from you, right? It's going to learn what you like and what you don't like and the kind of answers that you like to questions. And in the background, we also do a bunch of work to kind of optimize for, you know, if you ask a question in ChatGPT, it's not really going to know your intent, right? Like you could be an 8-year-old, you could be 65, you could be a sales rep, you could be a software engineer, doesn't really know. In Pogio, like you're a salesperson. We build for salespeople. So there's a lot of context that we can infer there, even just around, you know, if you go and ask ChatGPT something about a company, who knows what it's going to give back? And you'll get good answers, don't get me wrong. But it's like in Pogio, we know that you're asking about revenue because you want to know the scale of the company and that's going to affect your positioning. And so there's a lot that you can do there to kind of, again, kind of going back to the concept of guardrails in a very different way, is that there are guardrails on the AI that you can sort of put in place, because you can infer a lot about what your user might care about just by virtue of who they are and the fact that they're using your product rather than a Perplexity or a ChatGPT.
Interesting. I kind of an interesting transition point there as well is inherently right now you're working with early adopters. Like what's some pattern recognition of like the type who's adopting, some lessons from working with early adopters, like just any perspectives there?
Yeah, this has been an area of a lot of learning. I think we had a lot of hypotheses going in to kind of where we would see receptivity and that sort of thing. Because if you look at news and prevailing thought pieces and things like that, I think pretty much every company is talking about AI in some way. I think it's kind of fair to say that. What we found though is that the companies that we have been working with, I should also mention, you know, we're in early access. There's a lot of people using our product. What we've tended to do is kind of give it to a lot of people, learn who likes it, why they like it, why they don't like it, and then spend time with the people who are like just really jazzed about this, because they're the ones that are going to give the feedback to go and build a really, really good product. And the thing that's been really interesting about the companies that fit that definition, in some ways it makes a lot of sense. In some ways it might be a little counter to what you think. It's not small companies. It's not small sales teams with credit cards that can go swipe. It's actually like the really good market leading companies that like winning, because they see AI and they're like, well, we won the last game and now AI helps us win the future. How do we get AI to as many people in our organization as possible? So you actually end up, you know, and most of our customers by design, at least at this point, are enterprise software sales teams. It tends to be where a lot of the best sellers, you know, kind of gravitate towards those companies anyways. And so what we've actually found is that if you were to go and look at the, you know, pick whatever list you want of enterprise software company by market cap or the hot, you know, 30 enterprise companies, it's like, it's actually those companies. It's not the company that is kind of trying to grow 10% and squeeze cash out, which I think some people think that's where a lot of the AI optimization happens, because there's like, oh, we can go and bring in AI and cut people and it'll make the P&L look better. Those companies are actually, at least in our experience, tend to be pretty afraid of new technologies. And even down to the point that in some of these companies that I'll just kind of call them the ones that like winning, when reps find the product and they like it, and they're like, this changes things, you know, whatever, this is 10x better, this is whatever, they go tell people, they tell their boss. It goes from the salesperson to the sales manager to the district director to the SVP, and it spreads up. If you look at some of these other companies, people are afraid to tell their coworkers about it, because if they tell their coworker, then maybe the CIO finds out and says, you can't have this, and takes it away, and they don't want it to get taken away. And so what's been really, really interesting is that pattern has been almost like a perfect fit, which is bizarre, actually. I expected a lot more variation, but it's to the point that we've actually been really kind of clear on who we work with and who we don't, because there's people who are like, give me this thing. I want more of it. This thing changes how we go to market. And then there's people that are kind of like, seem to be a little more waiting on the sidelines for a kind of very digestible, like, you know, AI will get solved in a year, and when it's a little cleaner, then we'll go just deploy it and it'll all be great, which that's not really how it works usually, right? And I think if you kind of roll this forward a year and there's something digestible, well, the early adopters are going to be onto the next thing, because they've been using this for a year already. And so that's been, not kind of surprised by the trend, but the starkness of the trend has actually been like almost startling, like hard to believe.
Well, that's like a dream product-led growth scenario that it works in the enterprise, right? If you had to choose where it's going to work, that's where you want it to work. And then for these early adopters versus the laggards, I think you're in a unique situation where like the customer, the user is really participating in the R&D, right? Like the learning curve, it's just that you need a deeper involvement to like refine how each person uses it. So they really should be advantaged against, you know, anyone who is waiting a year.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, just even as a founder, it's a really fun way to build a company, because my job is to talk to users. Like I still send all of our early access requests, and there's a lot, I spend an embarrassingly large amount of my day, like literally just sending early access requests. But I do it because I want you to reply to that email if something doesn't work, or if you think something is dumb, or if you're confused. And it really allows you to, you know, we're successful if sales reps are successful, period. Like that is how we build the company. Like when we first looked at the product, we made a really distinct decision that like the success of this company is based on augmenting salespeople, period. So you have to build a product that if you give it to a sales rep, they're going to love it and they're going to want to tell everyone else. I don't want a product that goes top down from the CRO, hey, you have to use this. Not that you can't be successful with those products. I don't think they're as fun to build. And I also think when you're talking, kind of going back to what we were talking about with kind of AI and workflows, it's like, if you want to be close to the workflow, you actually have to be there with the IC. There's no way around that, right? I don't want the SVP's idea of what the IC does all day. Like I want the IC to tell me what they're doing. And so I think it's just a really fun way to build a company and build the product, because it's like, hey, what do you think of this product? What's broken? What's confusing? What don't you like? Tell me your dream list of things that it could do. And I think the thing that's been super cool about AI and going back to like day zero of doing this was you kind of come up with these sci-fi scenarios of like, well, what if you took this data and that and wrapped it in this and tried to do this? And you get a lot closer to that pipe dream sci-fi scenario than you would think more often than not. And so a lot of what we do when we talk to customers is like, you get a sense for where we're going. I want to know, what about your day is monotonous and not really your best use of your time, but you have to do it anyways. I want you to give all of that to Poggio so we can do all of that for you, so that you can go do the things that you're good at, which is like being a person and building trust and shaking hands and reading body language and taking all of this data and this sort of synthesized data and figuring out how to best deploy it essentially into the real world. And so it really is just like, what do you do all day? How can we make your life better? And then as a company, our mission is to basically kind of continuously ask that question and then continuously execute against it. And then over time, you know, it's going to change. The technology changes, the capability changes. But at the end of the day, it's like, how do we make sales reps more successful? And if we do that, then the rest takes care of itself, at least in our view.
That's fascinating. And one dynamic you can imagine, right, is with all of these workflows intersecting, data, APIs, is you're going to come to a point, right, where there's the conversation intelligence, there's the CRM, there's the sales intelligence. Yep. And maybe the vendors don't want all of this workflow to come together. Or like, do you foresee any like competitive tensions or like data access limitations, right?
Yeah.
Interfering with this, the realization of the sci-fi scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a few things there. I think there's always, no matter what kind of application you're talking about, there's always some degree of tension there. You know, everyone is frenemies to some degree, you know, like Salesforce and Snowflake are best friends, but also, you know, there's competitive tension there in everything they do. I think that's sort of inevitable. I think one of the things for us is that a lot of the sort of data sources that we talk about, it's hard to imagine a world where people just turn off API access. I think LinkedIn has been notorious for doing that in the past. But if you look at, you know, companies like Salesforce or data warehouses, like the idea that Salesforce would say, okay, the API access, and it's not to us, it's actually our customer's API, right? It's like that they would go to our end customer, who again is, you know, a $30 billion public company that spends God knows how much money on Salesforce, and says like, your data in Salesforce, that API access is shut down or it's limited. Also, because, you know, at this point in time, this data gets replicated anywhere anyways. So if you know, a lot of it's in Snowflake, a lot of it's in all these other tools. And so I think there are a lot of vested interests in these kind of future applications, of course. And, you know, people are going to build things that are complementary and competitive and all these sorts of things. But I think at the end of the day, it feels like we're at a point that API access is kind of like a right that people are going to expect from their software vendors. And I think, you know, it would anger a lot of people if Salesforce turned off their API. And I think the other thing too, it's like, there's a lot of places to get this data now, and people are moving it into a lot of, not even just for Gen AI reasons, but just in general. It's like, you know, people put a lot of data in Snowflake. It's, you know, their whole value prop, and they're doing a lot of things with it there. And so, you know, there's no reason that we couldn't access it from there or from the CRM, things like that. And I think the thing that's nice about this too is like, if your core product works without these integrations, the integrations are additive. Like, you don't necessarily need them. It's like, you know, an example in our case is like, if you want data from your Gong calls, from all your customer conversations to update the sort of model of the customer, that's great. If you don't want to do that for whatever reason, or you don't use Gong, totally fine. Like, you just kind of are missing a piece of this data, but it's really no harm, no foul. There's nothing that really breaks. It's just less good. But if your floor for goodness is pretty high already, you're kind of in a pretty good place anyways.
Interesting. And that ties into another one of your Twitter takes. And this one was on moats and incumbents and, you know, the beginning part of it. And this is, you know, comparing like the largest vendors around like their internal capabilities to really innovate and like the way they're structured. And then I'll start quoting from here. The biggest innovation, AI innovation, happens for the end user, most of whom are disillusioned with incumbent ability to deliver anything of value for them. And while distribution moats absolutely exist, data moats aren't as big as people would expect for many categories. APIs are ubiquitous, thus accessible by startups. Also, the data that LLMs use is more varied, existing across sources anyways, which is why you see incumbents heavily pushing a data is the new oil narrative, not because data is the moat, but because they want data to be the moat. And I thought that was incredibly insightful. And is there anything you want to elaborate on that topic?
Yeah. So I think one thing, maybe like an addendum on that tweet, I think there probably are markets where this isn't as true. Someone actually had afterwards, I was kind of conversing through Twitter DMs with someone, and they mentioned security data, like a CrowdStrike. And CrowdStrike totally has a data moat, right? Like they have all this telemetry from all these endpoints. Like there is absolutely a data moat for that product. I think if you look at these kind of SaaS business apps, and again, this kind of goes back to, you know, what does a system of record actually contain? And it's exhaust from process for the most part. And if you were to go look at an opportunity record in Salesforce and reverse engineer an opportunity record to like literally the day to day of what a sales rep did and why they did it, like that's hard to do. That's basically impossible. And so if you look at what, you know, data like a Salesforce or a Workday has that is kind of irreplaceable, if you are kind of moving towards these end user workflows, then that data is actually just a lot less useful than I think you might expect. And it's actually been surprising to me as I've kind of built the product and as I've thought about, you know, what data do we want access to and how would we use it? I think one of the things here too, it's like, this doesn't mean that like the systems of record aren't valuable. They're still incredibly valuable. It's just that you have this new surface area of product that at first glance looks quite related, but if you actually break it down, there's kind of like a gulf in between, right? Like, and I think that has been surprising to me, and I think will probably be surprising to people in the future. And again, look, distribution moats are unbelievable. Like having a distribution advantage, amazing. But I think people are going to be surprised how different these new products are than previous products, and how you really just have a much smaller advantage with that user base capture, particularly because over time, these really big systems of record, rightfully so, like this is the way they should go. It's like they move up market to go talk to the CIO, because if you're going to go sell a $10 million enterprise deal, you're talking to the CIO, you're talking to the data leader, you're talking to the CEO, you're selling digital transformation at the exec level. And, you know, that often comes at the expense of the kind of lower people on the totem pole who are forced to interact with these systems. And I think that's just the natural way that these systems evolve. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's not that the incumbents are doing anything particularly wrong. That's just how innovation cycles tend to work. And I think we're just looking at a cycle where the kind of enabling technology of LLMs under the hood changes a lot of things and just makes that shift that much more dramatic. It would have been happening anyways. It's just that now it's kind of, you know, pick your multiplier, 10x, 100, whatever you want to slap on there. It's just fundamentally different. And in the same way that cloud allowed for a shift from on-prem to cloud, it's like now you have these kind of LLM enabled applications that it just supercharges the shift.
Interesting. And so, you know, to recap some of that, it sounds like just like you need to look at everything workflow by workflow from a data perspective, you need to look at it like data block by data block, and not everything is useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that sort of brings up another kind of thought I've had for a little while. It's like, I just sort of feel like people are looking at AI as an enabling technology a little too monolithically. And maybe this is just that takes that get big are monolithic by nature, because that's how they, you know, they take off. But I think when you look at problems, I think people are often looking at them almost like top down, right? Which is like you have this function, sales or filmmaking or marketing, and that you're going to go build, you know, models get better over time, which is true. They're going to get cheaper. And that you're going to get to the point that you just have this amazing model and you say, you know, OpenAI for sales, and you point it at the sales discipline and you press a button and it like solves sales or for movie making or for whatever. And I think products just don't really work like that. You kind of have to think about it the inverse way, which is like, what are the like atomic units of work that happen? How do you automate those units? And then how do they get stitched together into something bigger and coherent that allows you to like do more and more and more of those atomic units over time. And I think that's where the kind of like real product innovation comes from. And I think that you're basically starting from zero on that when you're building a new product, because it's a completely new workflow. It's untouched.
And so from like a company building perspective, like, does that slow things down? Like, you just inherently need more time with your customers. You need more trial and error. Like, what are some implications from a building AI versus kind of the playbook that's very, very, very well established in SaaS?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a great answer to that question, because I want to say yes. Like, I want to say it takes more time. I want to say you should spend more time with your customers. But I also have a hard time saying that you shouldn't have been doing that before. So I think it makes it just that much more important, maybe. Like you should have been doing it before. You absolutely need to be doing it now. But I do think part of it is you can invest in the end user in a way that you couldn't before in a lot of cases, because you can make that end user a lot better at their job. And if you're it's almost an incentive alignment sort of question, which is, you know, in the past, and some of this, by the way, is still hypothesis. These products don't exist. The commercial models are not well trodden. Like, maybe we look back at this in 18 months and like, wow, that guy was stupid. Like, he should have just been selling to the CEO the whole time. But I think if you're kind of looking at the value that you can bring to an end user, you know, at the end of the day, what does like a head of sales care about? They care about hitting their number, beating their number. They care about their reps being productive. They care about them ramping faster, like all that sort of stuff. And if you can just go directly to the rep, and instead of having to go sell this story to someone senior, it's just like, well, these reps are using this product and they're generating more pipeline. They're closing more deals. They're just across the board more productive. Like, who doesn't want that? And you can always package that up into a more exec level value prop. And so for us, and maybe this is a little bit of a strategic decision that we made as well, that, you know, you could agree with or disagree with, it's like, that's our unit of value, is like rep augmentation. And if you can augment the rep to just be better, like buy this product, if they are using this product, they will be some percentage better at their job, period, then there's always a way to package that up into value. And there's a lot of productization that you can do on top of that. And so I think absent that, I think you start to get into you're kind of almost, you know, building a product for an exec buyer and not for the end user. And I think it there's just some sort of misalignment there on the power of the technology. And if you're going to go find a big trend and grapple onto that trend and ride that wave, like, it's important to figure out like what the trend actually changes and make sure you're focused on what it changes and not the high level marketing message of what it changes, which is everywhere and kind of obvious, but like, it's high level and obvious, and so everyone's saying it, and it's just not that interesting when it comes to like the rubber hitting the road.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, again, on your Twitter feed, like, you've had some pretty crazy testimonials of people like, yeah, absolutely loving your product, and that seems to have like a different product-led growth equation. It's like stunning testimonials will have a different like K factor of referrals than you might have seen in traditional SaaS.
Yes.
What are some of like the enthusiasms, and like, what are people liking about your product right now?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I have a bit of a growing suspicion that there are other products that kind of fit this bill. And I'll answer your question in a second, but one kind of just plug, I do think you can, going back to the concept of building companies a little bit differently, I think when you're talking about automating units of work, you have like a value capture equation that's just a little bit different than in the past. And I think the ability to build software that, one, provides a lot of value to your end customer, but two, is designed to fit contextually with every single one of your end users, gives you this ability where in the past you would talk about is software configured or customized. That was something I'd been obsessed with. You know, I worked in low code, no code stuff forever. And so was all about, you know, is this software configured or customized? And it's almost different in AI, where it's like, it's kind of neither, because the product itself is built to match the context of the customer. Like it the product gets built based on customer context. And so I think when you have that sort of product, there's this scalability factor that feels a little bit different than in the past. And so you kind of get these wow experiences when you have software that is like built it is designed to like conform to you. Then it's just weird. And I think you get some of these things where it's these kind of like conceptual underpinnings of the product when that conceptual underpinning or that sort of concept like hits the real world and intersects with a customer experience, that's where you get the like, wow, magic moments of like, how does this work? Like, how does it know that? How does it do that? And I think that there's something special there, whether that's around, you know, that's going to feed into these, you know, algorithms for how you grow and all these formulas and stuff like that. But I think there's something fundamentally like kind of different about that. And so I think what we're seeing and you know, some of the testimonials that you're referring to, it's like, I think that's a little bit of that intersection of this new kind of software, just, you know, getting into someone's hands and experiencing something that they haven't seen before. And I think, you know, for us, you know, and just a little bit of an explainer, maybe you should have done this at the top, a little bit of how our product works, but it's essentially, you know, a sort of AI native workspace where we automate a bunch of the things that a sales rep does to build trust and rapport with their customer. And what that, if you kind of oversimplify that, what it tends to be is you're a seller at a company, you're trying to sell your software to another company. Your job as a seller is to basically find the things that that customer cares about, where is their pain, and then figure out how your product can potentially map to that pain, and then figure out how to convey that value to the customer and agree on some mutual kind of success criteria. And then you shake hands and you sign a deal and you sell software and hopefully it's successful and they renew. What Pojo basically does is we go and we figure out, what does your product do? Like, what are your SKUs? What's the value? How you talk about it? Like, why does your product exist? And then any customer you're going to go and sell to, we go and figure out, what does this customer care about? What is their CEO talking about? What are the analysts talking about in earnings calls or earnings transcripts? And how are they, you know, there's all this data about a customer's priorities. And what we basically do is we match that at scale for every customer interaction. And that's sort of the high level. And then if you look at everything that results from that, there's like a million other examples of taking your solution and matching it to customer pain. That's basically what sales is. It's like a million different interactions of like, what does this customer care about? What do I have to solve that problem? And then match. And then you just kind of like do that forever. And so Pojo helps you do that. And so if you're a sales rep and you're like, hey, I just got a new book of business. I'm now responsible for covering these 120 accounts, which by the way, last year, 2 years ago, I probably had 60 accounts. And I had an SDR that booked all the meetings for me because like money was free and people had budgets. Now it's like, hey, by the way, you have no SDR support. Instead of covering 60 accounts, you now cover 120. And by the way, because you don't have an SDR, you get to go book your own meetings. Like you're prospecting. And so the workload has just fundamentally changed for sales reps. So with Pojo, you're like, oh, you need 100 account plans? Like that doesn't take 3 weeks anymore. We'll build them better, faster. You'll get them in a day, and then you can actually go sell. And so if you kind of think about how many reps are at a company, how much time is wasted figuring out what customers care about, and then how much time is, I shouldn't say wasted, spent, because that's what you should be doing, but how much time is spent figuring out what are customer problems, how do we map to those? And it's not just like, again, there's not just a right answer, right? It's not like customer has initiative one and we have product A and they match. It's like this customer has a lot of initiatives. We have a lot of different products. We have a lot of different ways that we can position them. Here's a bunch of ways that you might want to consider. And so it just dramatically speeds up a lot of these really, really manual processes. And so if you think about a sales rep that's like, well, before I was going to go have to build all these account plans because like my boss said I had to, and it's going to take like literally weeks, and they're probably going to not be that great because I don't really have that much time. Now it's like, well, it's better than you could do before, and they're done yesterday. Like, you just got 3 weeks for free, right? And that's just like one use case. And so if you kind of roll that up to a sales leader who probably has spent the majority of their career tapping their sales reps on the shoulder and trying to get them to build better account plans, because account plans is how you sell big deals faster. All of a sudden it's like, wait, we just have this button that allows our reps to sort of collaborate with this AI to build these amazing account plans so that I can go and review them. And like, oh my God, instead of having to pull these 10 out of people, which usually is what happens, they're like, I want to see 10 account plans by Friday, go do it. And everyone scrambles to go do it. Now it's like, okay, well now you have account plans for every single account, like 80 instead of 10. And you multiply that across every sales rep you have. And it's like, holy crap, like this, and this is where these quotes come from. It's like, this changes the way we go to market, or like, it's funny, like we're starting to get quotes where I'm like, we can't even publish that because the number is too big. Like, I can't say 20x plus. Like, this accelerates us 20x plus. Like, that's like a fake number. Like, you know, no one says that. And so, I think you're starting to see these sorts of things show up because it, again, it kind of all goes back to this fundamentally different technology that enables you to solve, again, going back to solving customer problems. It's like our customer is the sales rep. And it's like, you want to go spend time with your customers. You don't want to go combing through 10Ks and 10Qs and listening to podcast appearances and like all this stuff. It's like, you just want to go and build a relationship with your customer. We give you the ammo to do that. And we take all that monotonous stuff off your plate, which, by the way, like that's what LLMs are awesome at, is like that sort of monotonous, sift through all the data, summarize it, draw inferences, all that grindy stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting. There's a lot in there, by the way. And as we get back to like the user expectation side of it, also like the value you're bringing changes any, you know, frustration. Like, okay, some of the data misdescribed the company's exactly. location. Well, it's also like we've never gone in reality at our company and looked at these earnings transcripts. Like it,
right.
In theory, we should have or could have, but we just have never done that. And so if we're and it's thoughtful and it's impressive to be talking about the CFO or what have you, that, you know, as users balance all of this out and as we get used to it, because there's all these fundamental unlocks, like having, you know, played around in your product, it's just doing a lot of things that are pretty novel and set a new standard.
Yeah. And one of the things that's kind of funny about that is like, we actually, you know, are sometimes struggling to figure out what to call this thing because there's not really much precedent for it. And it's like, hey, like, what does this do for you? Like, you know, because we have a lot of people that are talking about us internally. And, you know, we actually last week we had a really big company start talking about us at their sales kickoff. And I was like, so when you go tell people about what we do, like, what do you say? Right? Like, how do you describe this thing? And you get a lot of different answers from a lot of different people. And I think that's where a lot of the kind of like excitement comes from though. Cause I think it's actually a cooler place to be when people don't know how to describe your product. They're like, I love this thing, but I don't know what it is. As opposed to like, hey, there's this category and there's a Gartner MQ and Forrester says it's got to do these 47 things. And like, you know, if you only do 42 of the 47, like your product sucks. And like, it's just a kind of very different paradigm that you can kind of work under. And I think it lets you be a lot more creative. And we also get to listen to users in a way that like, we're not beholden to a magic quadrant of functionality. And if there's things that we think aren't the right direction, you know, like the platform doesn't really exist. No one's telling us we're wrong because there's no standard to judge it against. And so I think that's where, and again, you know, I haven't been through a cycle like this before where some new technology kind of appears and changes things. But I think that's where it's like one of those things where if people know what box to put you in, there's kind of limits to the box. If they don't know what box to put you in, like you build your own box, right? And you can go solve the problems you want. And I think that's what's been really exciting going back to like when this whole thing was just a little bit of a spark was like, oh, you could use an LLM to do that. And if you just did that one thing, like that could be a lot, right? Like that could really actually change people's day to day. And it turns out that, you know, in our case, that was sort of this concept of account research, very, very basic version of account research. And it was like, what if that's it? And from there, you can kind of grow into a bunch of other things. But yeah, you end up with this kind of very useful, but hard to describe nebulous AI workspace.
Yeah, it's a real research accelerant based on my testing of it. I was impressed. And look, we're coming to the end of the show, but we did have a good question from Twitter. And it was, and the context here is you're a very avid cyclist and it's very apparent. And so what are some lessons learned from cycling that you can apply to entrepreneurship and company building?
Yeah. So this is a topic that I could probably do a podcast series on, but I think one of the really big things about cycling and endurance sports in general, I think a lot of these are applicable to endurance sports, but you have to be really patient. You have to be really disciplined. You have to be willing to, you know, in the case of cycling, like the way you get fast is actually not by like riding fast all the time. It's by actually riding like relatively slow, like a lot, and then sometimes having bursts of fast, to oversimplify. Because if you're going to go be really good, like really, really good, like pro level, like you got to ride your bike 30 hours a week, and you don't sprint 30 hours a week. Like, it just doesn't work like that. And I think what you kind of end up, whether you're recreational or racing, it's like, there's a lot of ambiguity in that sort of mode of operating, right? Like, hey, I'm trying to win this game and I'm, you know, going at 70% for most of the game. Like, that's a weird feeling. But I think it's true of entrepreneurship too, where it's like, it kind of, you know, going back to the patience concept, it's like, there are moments where you just sit in ambiguity and you don't know where you are or how well you're doing until far later. But you've got a plan, you trust the process, and you kind of know it's the right thing. And then as you learn more, you can kind of adjust. And one thing too to sort of point out is the company name actually comes from this premise. So Poggio is an Italian word that means like small hill, but in particular, it refers to a small hill in Sanremo in Italy, which is the end of a race called Milan-Sanremo, which is my personal favorite bike race, which starts in Milan, ends in Sanremo. It's sort of well known because it's the longest professional bike race, so one day race. And people find it really boring because if you go from Milan to Sanremo, if you're familiar with Italian geography, like it's actually not that hilly, like it's fairly flat by pro cycling standards. And so it's this race that's 300 kilometer race. And basically the way you win is you, as a team, it's all about teamwork and team tactics and protecting your team leader from kilometer zero to 297. And it's kind of boring, depending on who you are. And then everything is basically decided at the foot of the Poggio, which is the last 3 kilometers of the race. It's not a particularly large hill, but after 7 hours of riding your bike, it feels like a large hill. And it's all about getting your team leader to the foot of the Poggio in the right place so that they can compete to get to the top of the Poggio fastest. And the person that gets to the top tends to, at least in recent history, tends to win. And so it's this thing where you like sit in ambiguity for like literally for 8 hours in this race. Imagine you're a pro cyclist, you've been training, you know, like this might be the one day of the year that you're trying to win. And for 7.5 hours of this race, you actually don't even know how good you feel. You don't know if your legs are good. You have no idea if you're going to be able to compete, but you do it anyways. And your entire team sits there working for you so that for the last 3 kilometers of the race, like you have a chance to win. And sometimes you don't have a chance because your legs are bad and you didn't know. And so it's one of these things where like, it's really a game of sort of patience and preparation. And I think the thing I love about cycling is like, we talk about this being a boring and kind of relaxed race, but like they're going insanely fast. Like a normal person would not, you know, at no point in that race would feel comfortable, but that's the kind of level that you're competing on, and these margins matter, and doing the right thing matters. And I think, you know, for team building and company strategy is particularly in a super unknown market. It's like, for me, it's a little bit reassuring because that I learned from cycling how to kind of be a little more present and kind of, you know, trust yourself in those sorts of things. And I think if you're building a company, like you have to have that confidence, and you have to like really trust the process and be willing to change the process as circumstances change. But it's sort of high pressure, but you know, running at a what for you might be 70-80%, but for the normal human is sort of a lot lower. And people struggle with that because you want to feel like you're sprinting all the time, or at least sometimes, but if you know that you can't, because then you're actually not sprinting.
Awesome. Like, that is an amazing answer. And this has been a great episode. Where can people find you? How can they work with you? Give you a chance to promote yourself here for all the value you've added to the show.
Sure. Yeah. So if you're a sales rep or a sales leader that's interested in Poggio, poggio.io, there's a little early access form. I man the other side of that, so I will be in touch. Alternatively, you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I also am pretty responsive on both of those places. So if you want the Poggio, you can ask for Poggio access anywhere, any of those three, I'll reply. If you want the, you know, takes of varying degrees, Twitter's better for that. LinkedIn's catching up, but I'm pretty responsive everywhere. And then obviously, if you live in the San Francisco Bay Area and you see me on a bike, you can also holler.
Awesome. Well, look, this has been great. Look forward to getting on the web, and we'll have a lot of this in the show notes, promoting and including all of your content.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
Thanks.